Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Lectures on Landscape, Lecture 1, Outline, by John Ruskin. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. 1. In my inaugural lecture, I stated that while holding this professorship, I should direct you, in your practical exercises, chiefly to natural history and landscape. And having, in the course of the past year, laid the foundational elements of art sufficiently before you, I will invite you now to enter on real work with me, and accordingly I propose, during this and the following term, to give you what practical leading I can in elementary study of landscape, and of a branch of natural history which will form a kind of center for all the rest, ichthyology. In the outset, I must shortly state to you the position which landscape painting and animal painting hold towards the higher branches of art. Landscape painting is the thoughtful and passionate representation of the physical conditions appointed for human existence. It imitates the aspects and records the phenomena of the visible things which are dangerous or beneficial to men, and displays the human methods of dealing with these, and of enjoying them or suffering from them, which are either exemplary or deserving of sympathetic contemplation. Animal painting investigates the laws of greater and less nobility of character in organic form, as comparative anatomy examines those of greater and less development in organic structure. And the function of animal painting is to bring into notice the minor and unthought-of conditions of power or beauty, as that of physiology is to ascertain the minor conditions of adaptation. Questions as to the purpose of arrangements or the use of the organs of an animal are, however, no less within the province of the painter than of the physiologist, and are indeed more likely to commend themselves to you through drawing than dissection. For as you dissect an animal, you generally assume its form to be necessary and only examine how it is constructed, but in drawing the outer form itself attentively, you are led necessarily to consider the mode of life for which it is disposed, and therefore to be struck by an awkwardness or apparent uselessness in its parts. After sketching one day several heads of birds, it becomes a vital matter of interest to me to know the use of the bony process on the head of the hornbill. But on asking a great physiologist, I found that it appeared to him an absurd question, and was certainly an unanswerable one. I have limited, you have just heard, landscape painting to the representation of phenomena relating to human life. You will scarcely be disposed to admit the propriety of such a limitation, and you will still less be likely to conceive its necessary strictness and severity, unless I convince you of it by somewhat detailed examples. Here are two landscapes by Turner in his greatest time, Vesuvius in Repose, Vesuvius in Eruption. One is a beautiful harmony of cool color, the other of hot, and they are both exquisitely designed in ornamental lines, but they are not painted for those qualities. They are painted because the state of the scene in one case is full of delight to men, and in the other of pain and danger. And it is not Turner's object at all to exhibit or illustrate natural phenomena, however interesting in themselves. He does not want to paint blue mist in order to teach you the nature of evaporation, nor this lava stream to explain to you the operation of gravity on ponderous and viscous materials. He paints the blue mist because it brings life and joy to men, and the lava stream because it is death to them. Again, here are two sea pieces by Turner of the same period, photographs from them at least. One is a calm on the shore at Scarborough, the other the wreck of an Indiaman. These also are each painted with exquisitely artistic purpose, the first in opposition of local black to diffuse sunshine, the second the decorative grouping of white spots on a dark ground. That decorative purpose of dappling is as studiously and deliciously carried out by Turner, with the Daedalus side of him, in the inlaying of these white spots on the Indiaman's deck, as if he were working a precious toy in ebony and ivory. But Turner did not paint either of the sea pieces for the sake of these decorous arrangements, neither did he paint the Scarborough as a professor of physical science to show you the level of low tide on the Yorkshire coast, nor the Indiaman to show you the force of impact in a liquid mass of seawater of given momentum. He painted this to show you the daily course of quiet human work and happiness, and that to enable you to conceive something of uttermost human misery, both ordered by the power of the great deep. You may easily, you must, perhaps, for a little time, suspect me of exaggerating in this statement. It is so natural to suppose that the main interest of landscape is essentially in rocks and water and sky, and that figures are to be put, like the salt and mustard, to a dish, only to give it a flavor. Put all that out of your heads at once. The interest of a landscape consists wholly in its relation either to figures present, or to figures past, or to human powers conceived. The most splendid drawing of the chain of the Alps, irrespective of their relation to humanity, is no more a true landscape than a painting of this bit of stone. For as natural philosophers, there is no bigness or littleness to you. This stone is just as interesting to you, or ought to be, as if it was a million times as big. There is no more sublimity, per se, in ground sloped at an angle of 45 than in ground level, nor in a perpendicular fracture of a rock than in a horizontal one. The only thing that makes the one more interesting to you in a landscape than the other is that you could tumble over the perpendicular fracture and couldn't tumble over the other. A cloud, looked at as a cloud only, is no more a subject for painting than so much feculence in dirty water. It is merely dirty air, or at best a chemical solution ill made. That it is worthy of being painted at all depends upon its being the means of nourishment and chastisement to men, or the dwelling place of imaginary gods. There's a bit of blue sky and cloud by Turner, one of the loveliest ever painted by human hand, but as a mere pattern of blue and white, he had better have painted a jay's wing. This was only painted by him, and is, in reality, only pleasant to you, because it signifies the coming of a gleam of sweet sunshine in windy weather. And the wind is worth thinking of only because it fills the sails of ships, and the sun because it warms the sailors. Now, it is most important that you should convince yourself of and fully enter into this truth, because all the difficulty in choosing subject arises from mistakes about it. I dare say some of you who are fond of sketching have gone out often in the most beautiful country, and yet with the feeling that there was no good subject to be found in it. That always arises from your not having sympathy enough with its vital character, and looking for physical picturesqueness instead. On the contrary, there are crude efforts at landscape painting, made continually upon the most splendid physical phenomena in America and other countries without any history. It is not of the slightest use. Niagara or the North Pole and the Aurora Borealis won't make a landscape, but a ditch at Iffley will, if you have humanity in you, enough in you to interpret the feelings of hedgers and ditchers and frogs. Next, here is one of the most beautiful landscapes ever painted, the best I have next to Greta and Tees. The subject physically is a mere bank of grass above a stream with some witch elms and willows, a level-topped bank. The water has cut its way down through the soft alluvium of an elevated plain to the limestone rock at the bottom. Had this scene been in America, no mortal could have made a landscape of it. It is nothing but a grass bank with some not very pretty trees scattered over it, wholly without grouping. The stream at the bottom is rocky indeed, but its rocks are mean, flat, and of a dull yellow color. The sky is gray and shapeless. There is absolutely nothing to paint anywhere of a central landscape subject as commonly understood. Now see what the landscape consists in, which I have told you is one of the most beautiful ever painted by man. There's first a little bit of it left nearly wild, not quite wild. There's a cart and a rider's track through it among the copse. And then, standing simply on the wild moss, trooper's ground, the scattered ruins of a great abbey, seen so dimly that they seem to be fading out of sight in color as in time. These two things together, the wild copse wood and the ruin, take you back into the life of the 14th century. The one is the border rider's kingdom, the other that of peace which has striven against border riding, how vainly. Both these are remains of the past, but the outhouses and refectory of the abbey have been turned into a farmhouse, and that is inhabited, and in front of it the mistress is feeding her chickens. You see, the country is perfectly quiet and innocent, for there is no trace of offense anywhere. The cattle have strayed down to the riverside, it being a hot day, and some rest in the shade and two in the water. They could not have done so at their ease had the river not been humanized. Only a little bit of its stony bed is left. A mill weir thrown across stays the water in a perfectly clear and delicious pool. To show how clear it is, Turner has put the only piece of playing color in all the picture into the reflection in this. One cow is white, another white and red. Evidently as clean as morning dew can wash their sides. They could not have been so in a country where there was the least coal smoke. So Turner has put a wreath of perfectly white smoke through the trees, and lest that should not be enough to show you they burnt wood, he has made his foreground of a piece of copse just lopped, with the new faggot standing up against it. And this still not being enough to give you the idea of perfect cleanliness, he has covered the stones of the riverbed with white clothes laid out to dry, and that not being enough yet, for the riverbed might be clean, though nothing else was, he has put a quantity more hanging over the abbey walls. Only natural phenomena in their direct relation to humanity, these are to be your subjects in landscape. Rocks and water and air may no more be painted for their own sakes than the armor carved without the warrior. But secondly, I said landscape is to be a passionate representation of these things. It must be done, that is to say, with strength and depth of soul. This is, indeed, to some extent merely the particular application of a principle that has no exception. If you are without strong passions, you cannot be a painter at all. The laying of paint by an insensitive person, whatever it endeavors to represent, is not painting, but daubing or plastering. And that, observe, irrespective of the boldness or minuteness of the work. An insensitive person will daub with a camel's hairbrush and ultramarine, and a passionate one will paint with mortar and trowel. But far more than common passion is necessary to paint landscape. The physical conditions there are so numerous, and the spiritual ones so occult, that you are sure to be overpowered by the materialism, unless your sentiment is strong. No man is naturally likely to think first of anatomy in painting a pretty woman, but he is very aptly to do so in painting a mountain. No man of ordinary sense will take pleasure in features that have no meaning, but he may easily take it in heath, woods, or waterfalls that have no expression. So that it needs much greater strength of heart and intellect to paint landscape than figure. Many commonplace persons, bred in good schools, have painted the figure pleasantly or even well, but none but the strongest, John Bellini, Titian, Velasquez, Tintoret, Mantegna, Alessandro Botticelli, Carpaccio, and Turner have ever painted a fragment of good landscape. In missal painting, exquisite figure drawing is frequent, and landscape backgrounds in late works are elaborate, but I only know thoroughly good landscapes in one book, and I have examined, I speak deliberately, thousands. For one thing, the passion is necessary for the mere quantity of design. In good art, whether painting or sculpture, I have again and again told you every touch is necessary and beautifully intended. Now it falls within the compass of ordinary application to place rightly all the folds of drapery or gleams of light on a chain, or ornaments in a pattern. But when it comes to placing every leaf in a tree, the painter gets tired. Here, for instance, is a little bit of Sandro Botticelli background. I have purposely sketched it in the slightest way, that you might see how the entire value of it depends on thoughtful placing. There is no texture aimed at, no completion, scarcely any variety of light and shade, but by mere care in the placing the thing is beautiful. Well, every leaf, every cloud, every touch is placed with the same care and great work, and when this is done, as by John Bellini, in the picture of Peter Martyr, or as it was by Titian in the great Peter Martyr, with every leaf in a wood, he gets tired. I know no other such landscape in the world as that is, or as that was. Perhaps you think on such conditions you never can paint a landscape at all. Well, great landscape certainly not, but pleasant and useful landscape, yes, provided only the passion you bring to it be true and pure. The degree of it you cannot command, the genuineness of it you can. Yes, and the depth of source also. Tintoret's passion may be like the Reichenbach, and yours only like a little dripping Holywell, but both equally from deep springs. But though the virtue of all painting, and similarly of sculpture and every other art, is in passion, I must not have you begin by working passionately. The discipline of youth, in all its work, is in cooling and curbing itself, as the discipline of age is in warming and urging itself. You know the Bacchic chorus of old men in Plato's Laws. To the end of life, indeed, the strength of a man's finest nature is shown in due continence. But that is because the finest nature remains young to the death. And for you, the first thing you have to do in art, as in life, is to be quiet and firm, quiet above everything, and modest, with this most essential modesty, that you must like the landscape you are doing, and to draw better than you expect to like your drawing of it, however well it may succeed. If you would not rather have the real thing than your sketch of it, you are not in a right state of mind for sketching at all. If you only think of the scene, what a nice sketch this will make, be assured you will never make a nice sketch of it. You may think you have produced a beautiful work, nay, perhaps the public and many fair judges will agree with you, but I tell you positively, there will be no enduring value in what you have thus done. Whereas if you think of the scene, ah, if I could only get some shadow or scrawl of this to carry away with me, how glad I should be. Then, whatever you do will be, according to your strength, good and progressive. It may be feeble or much faultful, but it will be vital and essentially precious. Now, it is not possible for you to command this state of mind, nor anything like it, in yourselves at once. Nay, in all probability, your eyes are so satiated by the false popular art surrounding us now on all sides that you cannot see the delicate reality, though you try. But even though you may not care for the truth, you can act as if you did, and tell it. Now, therefore, observe this following quite plain direction. Whenever you set yourself to draw anything, consider only how best you may give a person who has not seen the place a true idea of it. Use any means in your power to do that, and don't think of the person for whom you are drawing as a connoisseur, but as a person of ordinary sense and feeling. Don't get artist-like qualities for him, but first give him the pleasant sensation of being at the place. Then show him how the land lies, how the water runs, how the wind blows, and so on. Always think of the public as Molière, of his old woman. you have done nothing really great or good if you can't please her. Now, beginning wisely so as to lose no time or labor, you will learn to paint all the conditions of quiet light and sky before you attempt those of variable light and cloud. Do not trouble yourselves with or allow yourselves to be tempted by any effects that are brilliant or tremendous. Accept only that from the beginning. I recommend you to watch always for sunrise, to keep a little diary of the manner of it, and to have beside your window a small sketchbook with pencil cut overnight, and colors moist. The one indulgence which I would have you allow yourself in fast coloring for some time is the endeavor to secure some record at the instant of the colors of morning clouds, while, if they are merely white or gray or blue, you must get an outline of them with your pencil. You will soon feel by this means what are the real difficulties to be encountered in all landscape coloring, and your eyes will be educated to the quality and harmonious action of forms. But for the rest, learn to paint everything in the quietest and simplest light. First, outline your whole subject completely with delicate, sharp pencil line. If you don't get more than that, let your outline be a finished and lovely diagram of the whole. All the objects are then to be painted of their proper colors, matching them as nearly as you can, in the manner that a missal is painted, filling the outline shapes neatly up to their junctions, reinforcing afterwards when necessary, but as little as possible, but above all, knowing precisely what the light is and where it is. I have brought two old-fashioned colored engravings which are a precise type of the style I want you to begin with. Finished from corner to corner, as well as the painter easily could, everything done to good purpose, nothing for vain glory, nothing in haste or affectation, nothing in feverish or morbid excitement. The observation is accurate, the sentiment, though childish, deep and pure, and the effect of light for common work, quite curiously harmonious and deceptive. They are, in spite of their weakness, absolutely the only landscapes I could show you which give you a real idea of the places, or which put your minds into the tone which, if you were happy and at ease, they would take in the air and light of Italy. I dwell on the necessity of completion especially because I have lost much time myself from my sympathy with the feverish intensity of the minds of great engravers, and from always fastening on one or two points of my subject and neglecting the rest. We have seen, then, that every subject is to be taken up first in its terminal lines, then in its light and shade, then in its color. First of the terminal lines of landscape, or of drawing an outline. I think the examples of shell outline in your copying series must already have made you feel the exact nature of a pure outline, the difficulty of it, and the value. But we have now to deal with limits of a more subtle kind. The outline of any simple solid form, even though it may have complex parts, represents an actual limit, accurately to be followed. The outline of a cup, of a shell, or an animal's limb has a determinable course which your pen or pencil line either coincides with or does not. You can say of that line either it is wrong or right. If right, it is in a measure suggestive, and nobly suggestive of the character of the object. But the greater number of objects in a landscape either have outlines so complex that no pencil could follow them, as trees in middle distance, or they have no actual outline at all, but a gradated and softened edge, as, for the most part, clouds, foam, and the like. And even in things which have determinate form, the outline of that form is usually quite incapable of expressing its real character. Here is the most ordinary component of a foreground, for instance, a pleasantly colored stone. Any of its pure outlines are not only without beauty, but absolutely powerless to give you any notion of its character, although that character is in itself so interesting that here Turner has made a picture of little more than a heap of such stones, with blue water to oppose their color. In consequence of these difficulties and insufficiencies, most landscape painters have been tempted to neglect outline altogether, and think only of effects of light or color on masses more or less obscurely defined. They have thus gradually lost their sense of organic form, their precision of hand, and their respect for limiting law. In a word, for all the safeguards and severe dignities of their art. And landscape painting has, therefore, more in consequence of this one error than of any other, become weak, frivolous, and justly despised. Now, if any of you have chanced to notice at the end of my Queen of the Air my saying that in landscape Turner must be your only guide, you perhaps have thought I said so because of his great power in melting colors or in massing light and shade. Not so. I have always said he's the only great landscape painter, and to be your only guide, because he is the only landscape painter who can draw an outline. His finished works perhaps appear to you more vague than any other master's. No man loses his outlines more constantly. You will be surprised to know that his frankness in losing depends on his certainty of finding if he chooses, and that, while all other landscape painters study from nature in shade or color, Turner always sketches with the point. Always, of course, is a wide word. In your copying series, I have put a sketch by Turner in color from nature. Some few others of the kind exist in the National Gallery and elsewhere, but as a rule, from his boyhood to the last day of his life, he sketched only with the fine pencil point, and always the outline, more if he had time, but at least the outline of every scene that interested him, and in general outlines so subtle and elaborate as to be inexhaustible in examination and uncopyable for delicacy. Here is a sketch of an English park scene which represents the average character of a study from nature by Turner. And here the sketch from nature of Dunblane Abbey for the Liber Studiorum, which shows you what he took from nature when he had time only to get what was most precious to him. The first thing, therefore, you have to learn in landscape is to outline, and therefore we must know precisely what an outline is, how it ought to be represented, and this it will be right to define in quite general terms applicable to all subjects. We saw in the fifth lecture that every visible thing consisted of spaces of color, terminated either by sharp or gradated limits. Whenever they are sharp, the line of separation, followed by the point of your drawing instrument, is the proper outline of your subject, whether it represents the limits of flat spaces or of solid forms. For instance, here is a drawing by Holbein of a lady in a dark dress, with bars of black velvet round her arm. Her form is seen everywhere defined against the light by a perfectly sharp linear limit, which Holbein can accurately draw with his pen. The patches of velvet are also distinguished from the rest of her dress by a linear limit, which he follows with his pen just as decisively. Here, therefore, is your first great law. Whenever you see one space of color distinguished from another by a sharp limit, you are to draw that limit firmly, and that is your outline. Also, observe that as your representing this limit by a dark line is a conventionalism, and just as much a conventionalism when the line is subtle as when it is thick, the great masters accept and declare that conventionalism with perfect frankness, and use bold and decisive outline, if any. Also observe that though, when you are master of your art, you may modify your outline by making it dark in some parts, light in others, and even sometimes thick and sometimes slender, a scientifically accurate outline is perfectly equal throughout. And in your first practice, I wish you to use always a pen with a blunt point, which will make no hair stroke under any conditions, so that using black ink and only one movement of the pen, not returning to thicken your line, you shall either have your line there or not there, and that you may not be able to gradate or change it in any way or degree whatsoever. Now the first question respecting it is, what place is your thick line to have with respect to the limit which it represents, outside of it, or inside, or over it? Theoretically, it is to be over it, the true limit falling all the way along the center of your thick line. The contest of Apelles with Protogenes consisted in striking this true limit within each other's lines, more and more finely, and you may always consider your pen line as representing the first incision for sculpture, the true limit being the sharp center of the incision. But, practically, when you are outlining a light object defined against a dark one, the line must go outside of it, and when a dark object against a light one, inside of it. In this drawing of Holbein's, the hand being seen against the light, the outline goes inside the contour of the fingers. Secondly, and this is of great importance, it will happen constantly that forms are entirely distinct from each other and separated by true limits, which are yet invisible, or nearly so, to the eye. I place, for instance, one of these eggs in front of the other, and probably to most of you the separation in the light is indiscernible. Is it then to be outlined? In practically combining outline with accomplished light and shade, there are cases of this kind in which the outline may, with advantage, or even must, for truth of effect, be omitted. But the facts of the solid form are of so vital importance, and the perfect command of them so necessary to the dignity and intelligibility of the work, that the greatest artists, even for their finished drawings, like to limit every solid form by a fine line, whether its contour be visible to the eye or not. An outline thus perfectly made with absolute decision, and with a wash of one color above it, is the most masterly of all methods of light and shade study, with limited time, when the forms of the object to be drawn are clear and unaffected by mist. But without any wash of color, such an outline is the most valuable of all means for obtaining such memoranda of any scene as may explain to another person, or record for yourself what is most important in its features. Choose then a subject that interests you, and so far as failure or time or materials compels you to finish one part, or express one character rather than another, of course dwell on the features that interest you most. But beyond this, forget, or even somewhat repress yourself, and make it your first object to give a true idea of the place to other people. You are not to endeavor to express your own feelings about it. If anything, err on the side of concealing them. What is best is not to think of yourself at all, but to state as plainly and simply as you can the whole truth of the thing. What you think unimportant in it may, to another person, be the most touching part of it. What you think beautiful may be, in truth, commonplace and of small value. Quietly complete each part to the best of your power, endeavoring to maintain a steady and dutiful energy and the tranquil pleasure of a workman. End of Lecture 1.
Lectures on Landscape. Lecture 2, Light and Shade, by John Ruskin. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Kirsten Ferreri. Lecture 2, Light and Shade. In my last lecture, I laid before you evidence that the greatness of the master whom I wished you to follow as your only guide in landscape depended primarily on his studying from nature always with the point, that is to say, in pen or pencil outline. Today I wish to show you that his preeminence depends secondarily on his perfect rendering of form and distance by light and shade, before he admits a thought of color. I say before, however, observe carefully only with reference to the construction of any given picture, not with reference to the order in which he learnt his mechanical processes. From the beginning he worked out of doors with the point, but indoors with the brush, and attains perfect skill in washing flat color long before he attains anything like skill in delineation of form. Here, for instance, is a drawing when he was 12 or 13 years old, of Dover Castle and the Dover Coach, in which the future love of mystery is exhibited by his studiously showing the way in which the dust rises about the wheels, and an interest in drunken sailors, which materially affected his marine studies, shown not less in the occupants of the hind seat. But what I want you to observe is that, though the trees, coach, horses, and sailors are drawn as any schoolboy would draw them, the sky is washed in so smoothly that few watercolor painters of our day would lightly accept a challenge to match it. And therefore it is, among many other reasons, that I put the brush into your hands from the first, and try you with a wash in lampblack before you enter my working class. But as regards the composition of his picture, the drawing is always first with Turner, the colour second. Drawing, that is to say, the expression by gradation of light, either of form or space. Again, I thus give you a statement wholly adverse to the vulgar opinion of him. You will find that statement early in the first volume of Modern Painters, and repeated now through all my works these 25 years, in vain. Nobody will believe that the main virtue of Turner is in his drawing. I say the main virtue of Turner. Splendid though he be as a colourist, he is not unrivalled in colour. Nay, in some qualities of colour he has been far surpassed by the Venetians. But no one has ever touched him in the exquisiteness of gradation, and no one in landscape, in perfect rendering of organic form. I showed you in this drawing, at last lecture, how truly he had matched the colour of the iron-stained rocks in the bed of the Ticino, and any of you who care for colour at all cannot but take more or less pleasure in the black and greens and warm browns opposed throughout. But the essential value of the work is not in these. It is first in the expression of enormous scale of mountain and space of air, by gradations of shade in these colours, whatever they may be, and secondly, in the perfect rounding and cleaving of the masses alike of mountain and stone. I showed you one of the stones themselves as an example of uninteresting outline. If I were to ask you to paint it, though its colour is pleasant enough, you would still find it uninteresting and coarse compared to that of a flower or a bird. But if I can engage you in an endeavour to draw its true forms in light and shade, you will most assuredly find it not only interesting, but in some points quite beyond the most subtle skill you can give to it. You have heard me state to you several times that all the masters who valued accurate form and modelling found the readiest way of obtaining the facts they required to be firm pen outline, completed by a wash of neutral tint. This method is indeed rarely used by Raphael or Michelangelo in the drawings they have left to us, because their studies are nearly all tentative, experiments in composition, in which the imperfect or careless pen outline suggested all they required, and was capable of easy change without confusing the eye. But the masters who knew precisely before they laid touch on paper what they were going to do, and this may be observed either because they are less or greater than the men who change, less in merely drawing some natural object without attempt at composition, or greater in knowing absolutely beforehand the composition they intend. It may be even so that what they intend, though better known, is not so good. But at all events, in this anticipating power, Tintoret, Holbein, and Turner stand, I think, alone as draughtsmen. Tintoret rarely sketching at all, but painting straight at the first blow, while Holbein and Turner sketch indeed, but it is as with pen of iron and a point of diamond. You will find in your educational series many drawings illustrative of the method, but I have enlarged here the part that is executed with the pen out of this smaller drawing, that you may see with what fearless strength Holbein delineates even the most delicate folds of the veil on the head, and of the light muslin on the shoulders, giving them delicacy, not by the thinness of his line, but by its exquisite veracity. The eye will endure with patience, or even linger with pleasure, on any line that is right, however coarse, while the faintest or finest that is wrong will be forcibly destructive. And again I have to recommend you to draw always as if you were engraving, and as if the line could not be changed. The method used by Turner in the Liber Studiorum is precisely analogous to that of Holbein. The lines of these etchings are to trees, rocks, or buildings absolutely what these of Holbein are, not suggestions of contingent grace, but determinations of the limits of future form. You will see the explanatory office of such lines by placing this outline over my drawing of the stone, until the lines coincide with the limits of the shadow. You will find that it intensifies and explains the forms which otherwise would have escaped notice, and that a perfectly gradated wash of neutral tint with an outline of this kind is all that is necessary for a grammatical statement of forms. It is all that the great colourists need for their studies. They would think it wasted time to go further. But if you have no eye for colour, you may go further in another manner with enjoyment. Now to go back to Turner. The first great object of the Liber Studiorum, for which I requested you in my sixth lecture to make constant use of it, is the delineation of solid form by outline and shadow. But a yet more important purpose in each of the designs in that book is the expression of such landscape powers and character as have especial relation to the pleasures and pain of human life, but especially the pain. And it is in this respect that I desired you to be assured not merely of their superiority, but of their absolute difference in kind from photography, as works of disciplined design. I do not know whether any of you were interested enough in the little note in my catalogue on this view near Blair Athol, to look for the scene itself during your summer rambles. If any did, and found it, I am nearly certain their impression would be only that of an extreme wonder how Turner could have made so little of so beautiful a spot. The projecting rock, when I last saw it, in 1857, and I am certain when Turner saw it, was covered with lichens having as many colours as a painted window. The stream, or rather powerful and deep Highland river, the Tilt, foamed and eddied magnificently through the narrow channel, and the wild vegetation in the rock crannies was a finished arabesque of living sculpture, of which this study of mine, made on another stream in Glenfinlass, only a few miles away, will give you a fair idea. Turner has absolutely stripped the rock of its beautiful lichens to bare slate, with one quartz vein running up through it. He has quieted the river into a commonplace stream. He has given, of all the rich vegetation, only one cluster of quite uninteresting leaves, and a clump of birches with ragged trunks. Yet observe, I have told you of it. He has put into one scene the spirit of Scotland. Similarly, those of you who in your long vacations have ever stayed near Dumblain will, I think, be disappointed in no small degree by this study of the abbey, for which I showed you the sketch at last lecture. You probably know that the oval window in its west end is one of the prettiest pieces of rough 13th-century carving in the kingdom. I used it for a chief example in my lectures at Edinburgh, and you know that the lancet windows, in their fine proportion and rugged masonry, would alone form a study of ruined Gothic masonry of exquisite interest. Yet you find Turner representing the lancet window by a few bare oval lines like the hoop of a barrel, and indicating the rest of the structure by a monotonous and thin piece of outline, of which I was asked by one of yourselves last term, and quite naturally and rightly, how Turner came to draw it so slightly, or we may even say, so badly. Whenever you find Turner stopping short, or apparently failing in this way, especially when he does the contrary of what any of us would have been nearly sure to do, then is the time to look for your main lesson from him. You recollect those quiet words of the strongest of all Shakespeare's heroes, when anyone else would have had his sword out in an instant, quote, "Keep up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them. Were it my cue to fight, I should have known it without a prompter." End quote. Othello, Act 1, Scene 2. Now you must always watch keenly what Turner's cue is. You will see his hand go to his hilt fast enough when it comes. Dumblain Abbey is a pretty piece of building enough, it is true, but the virtue of the whole scene and meaning is not in the masonry of it. There is much better masonry and much more wonderful ruin of it elsewhere. Dumblain Abbey, tower and aisles and all, would go under one of the arches of buildings such as there are in the world. Look at what Turner will do when his cue is masonry, in the Colosseum. What the execution of that drawing is, you may judge by looking with a magnifying glass at the ivy and battlements in this, when also his cue is masonry. What, then, can he mean by not so much as indicating one pebble or joint in the walls of Dumblain? I was sending out the other day to a friend in America a chosen group of the Liber Studiorum to form a nucleus for an art collection at Boston. And I warned my friend at once to guard his public against the sore disappointment their first sight of these much-celebrated works would be to them. You will have to make them understand, I wrote to him, that their first lesson will be in observing not what Turner has done, but what he has not done. These are not finished pictures, but studies. Endeavours, that is to say, to get the utmost result possible with the simplest means. They are essentially thoughtful, and have each their fixed purpose, to which everything else is sacrificed. And that purpose is always imaginative, to get at the heart of the thing, not at its outside. Now it is true there are beautiful lichens at Blair Athol, and good building at Dumblain, but there are lovely lichens all over the cold regions of the world, and there is far more interesting architecture in other countries than in Scotland. The essential character of Scotland is that of a wild and thinly inhabited rocky country, not sublimely mountainous, but beautiful in low rock and light streamlet everywhere, with sweet copsewood and rudely growing trees. This wild land possesses a subdued and imperfect school of architecture, and has an infinitely tragic feudal, pastoral, and civic history. And in the events of that history, a deep tenderness of sentiment is mingled with a cruel and barren rigidity of habitual character, accurately corresponding to the conditions of climate and earth. Now I want you especially to notice, with respect to these things, Turner's introduction of the ugly square tower high upon the left. Your first instinct would be to exclaim, "How unlucky that that was there at all! Why, at least, could not Turner have kept it out of sight? He has quite gratuitously brought it into sight, gratuitously drawn firmly the three lines of stiff dripstone which mark its squareness and blankness. It is precisely that blank vacancy of decoration and setting of the meagre angles against wind and war which he wants to force on your notice, that he may take you thoroughly out of Italy and Greece, and put you wholly in a barbarous and frost-hardened land, that once having its gloom defined, he may show you all the more intensely what pastoral purity and innocence of life, and loveliness of nature, are underneath the banks and braes of Down, and by every brooklet that feeds the Forth and Clyde." That is the main purpose of these two studies. How it is obtained by various incidents in the drawing of stones and trees and figures, I will show you another time. The chief element in both is the sadness and depth of their effect of subdued, though clear, light in sky and stream. The sadness of their effect, I repeat. If you remember anything of the lectures I gave you through last year, you must be gradually getting accustomed to my definition of the Greek school in art, as one essentially chiaroscurist, as opposed to Gothic color, realist, as opposed to Gothic imagination, and despairing, as opposed to Gothic hope. And you are prepared to recognize it by any one of these three conditions. Only observe the chiaroscuro is simply the technical result of the two others. A Greek painter likes light and shade, first because they enable him to realize form solidly, while color is flat, and secondly, because light and shade are melancholy, while color is gay. So that the defect of color, and substitution of more or less gray or gloomy effects of rounded gradation, constantly express the two characters, first, academic or Greek fleshliness and solidity as opposed to Gothic imagination, and secondly, of Greek tragic horror and gloom as opposed to Gothic gladness. In the great French room in the Louvre, if you at all remember the general character of the historical pictures, you will instantly recognize, in thinking generally of them, the rounded, fleshly, and solid character in the drawing, the gray or greenish and brownish color, or defect of color, lurid and moonlight-like, and the gloomy choice of subjects, as the deluge, the field of Eylau, the starvation on the raft, and the death of Endymion, always melancholy and usually horrible. The more recent pictures of the painter Jerome unite all these attributes in a singular degree. Above all, the fleshliness and materialism which make his studies of the nude, in my judgment, altogether inadmissible into the rank of the fine arts. Now you observe that I never speak of this Greek school but with a certain dread, and yet I have told you that Turner belongs to it, that all the strongest men in times of developed art belong to it, but then, remember, so do all the basest. The learning of the academy is indeed a splendid accessory to the original power in Velázquez, in Titian, or in Reynolds. But the whole world of art is full of a base learning of the academy, which, when fools possess, they become a tenfold plague of fools. And again, a stern and more or less hopeless melancholy necessarily is undercurrent in the minds of the greatest men of all ages, of Homer, Aeschylus, Pindar, or Shakespeare. But an earthly, sensual, and weak despondency is the attribute of the lowest mental and bodily disease, and the imbecilities and lassitudes which follow crime, both in nations and individuals, can only find a last stimulus to their own dying sensation in the fascinated contemplation of completer death. Between these, the highest, and these the basest, you have every variety and combination of strength and of mistake. The mass of foolish persons dividing themselves always between the two oppositely and equally erroneous faiths, that genius may dispense with law, or that law can create genius. Of the two, there is more excuse for and less danger in the first than in the second mistake. Genius has sometimes done lovely things without knowledge and without discipline, but all the learning of the academies has never yet drawn so much as one fair face, or even set two pleasant colors side by side. Now there is one great northern painter of whom I have not spoken till now, probably to your surprise, Rubens, whose power is composed of so many elements, and whose character may be illustrated so completely, and with it the various operation of the counter-schools, by one of his pictures now open to your study, that I would press you to set aside one of your brightest Easter afternoons for the study of that one picture in the exhibition of the old masters, the so-called Juno and Argus, number 387. So-called, I say, for it is not a picture either of Argus or of Juno, but the portrait of a Flemish lady as Juno, just as Rubens painted his family picture with his wife as the Virgin and himself as St. George, and a good anatomical study of a human body as Argus. In the days of Rubens, you must remember, mythology was thought of as a mere empty form of compliment or fable, and the original meaning of it wholly forgotten. Rubens never dreamed that Argus is the night, or that his eyes are stars, but with the absolutely literal and brutal part of his Dutch nature supposes the head of Argus full of real eyes all over, and represents Hebe cutting them out with a bloody knife and putting one into the hand of the goddess, like an unseemly oyster. That conception of the action, and the loathsome sprawling of the trunk of Argus under the chariot, are the essential contributions of Rubens's own Netherland personality. Then, with the rest of the treatment he learned from other schools, but adopted with splendid power. First, I think you ought to be struck by having two large peacocks painted with scarcely any color in them. They are nearly black or black-green peacocks. Now, you know that Rubens is always spoken of as a great colorist, par excellence a colorist, and would you not have expected that, before all things, the first thing you would have seen in a peacock would have been gold and blue? He sees nothing of the kind. A peacock, to him, is essentially a dark bird, serpent-like in the writhing of the neck, cloud-like in the toss and wave of its plumes. He has dashed out the filaments of every feather with magnificent drawing. He has not given you one bright gleam of green or purple in all the two birds. Well, the reason of that is that Rubens is not par excellence a colorist, nay, not even a good colorist. He is a very second-rate and coarse colorist, and therefore his color catches the lower public and gets talked about. But he is, par excellence, a splendid draftsman of the Greek school, and no one else except Tintoret could have drawn with the same ease either the muscles of the dead body or the plumes of the birds. Further, that he never became a great colorist does not mean that he could not, had he chosen. He was warped from color by his lower Greek instincts, by his animal delight in coarse and violent forms and scenes, in fighting, in hunting, and in torments of martyrdom and hell. But he had the higher gift in him, if the flesh had not subdued it. There is one part of this picture which he learned how to do at Venice, the iris with the golden hair in the chariot behind Juno. In her he has put out his full power, under the teaching of Veronese and Titian, and he has all the splendid northern Gothic, Reynolds or Gainsborough play of feature with Venetian color. Scarcely anything more beautiful than that head, or more masterly than the composition of it, with the inlaid pattern of Juno's robe beneath, exists in the art of any country. Si sic omnia, but I know nothing else equal to it throughout the entire works of Rubens. See then how the picture divides itself. In the fleshly baseness, brutality, and stupidity of its main conception is the Dutch part of it. That is Rubens's own. In the noble drawing of the dead body and of the birds, you have the Phidias Greek part of it, brought down to Rubens through Michelangelo. In the embroidery of Juno's robe, you had the Daedalus Greek part of it, brought down to Rubens through Veronese. In the head of Iris, you had the pure northern Gothic part of it, brought down to Rubens through Giorgione and Titian. Now, though, even if we had given 10 minutes of digression, the lessons in this picture would have been well worth it. I have not, in taking you to it, gone out of my own way. There is a special point for us to observe in those dark peacocks. If you look at the notes on the Venetian pictures in the end of my Stones of Venice, you will find it especially dwelt upon as singular that Tintoret, in his picture of the Nativity, has a peacock without any color in it. And the reason of it also, that Tintoret belongs with the full half of his mind, as Rubens does, to the Greek school. But the two men reach the same point by opposite paths. Tintoret begins with what Venice taught him, and adopted from what Athens could teach, but Rubens begins with Athens, and adopts from Venice. Now, if you will look back to my fifth lecture, you will find it said that the colorists can always adopt as much chiaroscuro as suits them, and so become perfect, but the chiaroscurists cannot on their part adopt color, except partially, and accordingly, whenever Tintoret chooses, he can laugh Rubens to scorn in management of light and shade. but Rubens only here and there, as far as I know myself, only this once, touches Tintoret or Giorgione colour. But now observe further. The Greek chiaroscuro, I have just told you, is by one body of men pursued academically, as a means of expressing form, by another tragically, as a mystery of light and shade, corresponding to and forming part of the joy and sorrow of life. You may, of course, find the two purposes mingled. But pure formal chiaroscuro, Marc Antonio's and Leonardo's, is inconsistent with colour, and though it is thoroughly necessary as an exercise, it is only as a correcting and guarding one, never as a basis of art. Let me be sure now that you thoroughly understand the relation of formal shade to colour. Here is an egg, here a green cluster of leaves, here a bunch of black grapes. In formal chiaroscuro, all these are to be considered as white, and drawn as if they were carved in marble. In the engraving of Melancholy, what I meant by telling you it was in formal chiaroscuro was that the ball is white, the leaves are white, the dress is white. You can't tell what colour any of these stand for. On the contrary, to a colourist, the first question about everything is its colour. Is this a white thing, a green thing, or a blue thing? Down must go my touch of white, green, or dark blue first of all. If afterwards I can make them look round, or like fruit and leaves, it is all very well, but if I can't, blue or green they at least shall be. Now, here you have exactly the thing done by the two masters we are speaking of. Here is a copy of Turner's Vignette of Martigny. This is wholly a design of the coloured school. Here is a bit of the vine in the foreground with purple grapes. The grapes, so far from being drawn as round, are stuck in with angular flat spots, but they are vividly purple spots. Their whole vitality and use in the design is in their Tyrian nature. Here, on the contrary, is Dürer's flight into Egypt, with grapes and palm fruit above. Both are white, but both engraved so as to look thoroughly round. All the other great chiaroscurists whom I name to you, Reynolds, Velasquez, and Titian, approached their colour also on the safe side, from Venice. They always think of colour first. But Turner had to work his way out of the dark Greek school up to Venice. He always thinks of his shadow first, and it held him in some degree fatally to the end. These pictures, which you all laughed at, were not what you fancied, mad endeavours for colour. They were agonizing Greek efforts to get light. He could have got colour easily enough if he had rested in that, which I will show you in next lecture. Still, he so nearly made himself a Venetian that, as opposed to the Dutch academical chiaroscurists, he is to be considered a Venetian altogether. And now I will show you, in a very simple subject, the exact opposition of the two schools. Here is a study of swans, from a Dutch book of academical instruction in Rubens's time. It is a good and valuable book in many ways, and you are going to have some copies set you from it. But as a type of academical chiaroscuro, it will give you most valuable lessons on the other side, of warning. Here, then, is the academical Dutchman's notion of a swan. He has laboriously engraved every feather, and has rounded the bird into a ball, and has thought to himself that never swan has been so engraved before. But he has never with his Dutch eyes perceived two points in the swan which are vital to it. First, that it is white, and secondly, that it is graceful. He has above all things missed the proportion, and necessarily, therefore, the bend of its neck. Now, take the colourist's view of the matter. To him, the first main facts about the swan are that it is a white thing with black spots. Turner takes his brush in his right hand, with a little white in it, another in his left hand with a little lampblack. He takes a piece of brown paper, works for about 2 minutes with his white brush, passes the black to his right hand, and works half a minute with that, and there you are. You would like to be able to draw two swans in 2 minutes and a half yourselves. Perhaps so, and I can show you how, but it will need 20 years' work all day long. First, in the meantime, you must draw them rightly, if it takes 2 hours instead of 2 minutes, and above all, remember that they are black and white. But further, you see how intensely Turner felt precisely what the Fleming did not feel, the bend of the neck. Now, this is not because Turner is a colourist, as opposed to the Fleming, but because he is a pure and highly trained Greek, as opposed to the Fleming's low Greek. Both, so far as they are aiming at form, are now working in the Greek school of Phidias, but Turner is true Greek, for he is thinking only of the truth about the swan, and De Witt is pseudo-Greek, for he is thinking not of the swan at all, but of his own Dutch self. and so he has ended in making, with all his essentially piggish nature, this sleeping swan's neck as nearly possible like a leg of a pork. That is the result of academical work, in the hands of a vulgar person. And now I will ask you to look carefully at three more pictures in the London exhibition. The first, The Nativity, by Sandro Botticelli. It is an early work by him, but a quite perfect example of what the masters of the pure Greek school did in Florence. One of the Greek main characters, you know, is to be, Greek, aprosopos, faceless. If you look first at the faces in this picture, you will find them ugly, often without expression, always ill or carelessly drawn. The entire purpose of the picture is a mystic symbolism by motion and chiaroscuro. By motion first, there is a dome of burning clouds in the upper heaven. 12 angels half float, half dance in a circle round the lower vault of it. All their drapery is drifted so as to make you feel the whirlwind of their motion. They are seen by gleams of silvery or fiery light, relieved against an equally lighted blue of inimitable depth and loveliness. It is impossible for you ever to see a more noble work of passionate Greek chiaroscuro, rejoicing in light. From this I should like you to go instantly to Rembrandt's Portrait of a Burgomaster, number 77 in the Exhibition of Old Masters. That is ignobly passionate chiaroscuro, rejoicing in darkness rather than light. You cannot see a finer work by Rembrandt. It has all his power of rendering character, and the portrait is celebrated through the world, but it is entirely second-rate work. The character in the face is only striking to persons who like candlelight effects better than sunshine. Any head by Titian has twice the character, and seen by daylight instead of glass. The rest of the picture is as false in light and shade as it is pretentious, made up chiefly of gleaming buttons in places where no light could possibly reach them, and of an embossed belt on the shoulder which people think finely painted because it is all over lumps of color, not one of which was necessary. That embossed execution of Rembrandt's is just as much ignorant work as the embossed projecting jewels of Carlo Crivelli. A real painter never loads. See the Velázquez, number 415 in the same exhibition. Finally, from the Rembrandt go to the little Sima, number 93, St. Mark. There you have the Sandro Botticelli of the noble Greek school in Florence, the Rembrandt of the debased Greek school in Holland, and the Sima of the pure color school of Venice. The Sima differs from the Rembrandt by being lovely, from the Botticelli by being simple and calm. The painter does not desire the excitement of rapid movement, nor even the passion of beautiful light. But he hates darkness as he does death, and falsehood more than either. He has painted a noble human creature simply in clear daylight, not in rapture, nor yet in agony. He is dressed neither in a rainbow, nor bedraggled with blood. You are neither to be alarmed nor entertained by anything that is likely to happen to him. You are not to be improved by the piety of his expression, nor disgusted by its truculence. But there is more true mastery of light and shade, if your eye is subtle enough to see it, in the hollows and angles of the architecture and folds of the dress, than in all the etchings of Rembrandt put together. The unexciting color will not at first delight you, but its charm will never fail, and from all the works of variously strained and obtrusive power with which it is surrounded, you will find that you never return to it but with a sense of relief and of peace, which can only be given you by the tender skill which is wholly without pretense, without pride, and without error. End of Lecture 2, Light and Shade.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.